The U.S. and Iran express optimism about their developing prisoner deal. We talked to a researcher about one issue getting little attention, Iran's demand for the U.S. to free Iranians arrested on federal charges.
The regime actually really prizes these people. They may seem like the little fish, but the regime thinks they are the big fish. They represent the nuts and bolts of the Iranian weapons system.
Plus, an Iranian-American whose father is jailed in Iran goes to the State Department to press for him to be included in a prisoner deal. And Iran goes to Latin America to promote its supreme leader's memoir. A former U.S. ambassador tells us why he is concerned.
When you look at the propaganda and the ideology, when you look at the books and the music videos that they're putting out, they want people to be martyrs.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Tuesday that Washington believes a recent understanding with Iran that would see Tehran release five Americans whom the U.S. deems wrongfully detained remains on track. Speaking to reporters, Sullivan said there is no timetable for when the five Americans would return home to their families. A day earlier, an Iranian foreign ministry spokesman told a news conference that the process in which those Americans would leave Iran will take a maximum of 2 months. The process began on August 10th, when Iran transferred four of the five Americans from prison to house arrest, joining the fifth American who already was under house arrest. Iran and the U.S. say their understanding also includes a U.S. agreement for billions of dollars of Iranian funds frozen in South Korean banks to be transferred to a third party to supply Iran with humanitarian aid. Tehran also says it expects the U.S. to free some of its citizens arrested on federal charges, something the U.S. has not confirmed. VOA has identified 11 Iranians whose release Tehran may be seeking. They include six Iranian-American dual nationals, two Iranian U.S. permanent residents, and three Iranians with no legal status in the U.S. I shared that list with Andrea Stricker, a researcher at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and asked her on the phone which of the individuals she thinks Iran would most want to be released.
Well, Michael, thank you for having me. I think you've actually covered this issue better than anybody. So the list is pretty disturbing, I think. There's a man who was arrested in 2011, and he's serving 25 years for being part of a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States.
That's Mansour Arbabsiar. It seems to be the most serious of all the offenses that these individuals were convicted of.
Right. And then there's another woman who's set to serve 4 years for facilitating financial transactions and the plot to kidnap Iranian-American activist Masi Alinejad from Brooklyn. There are several others. There was a man who pled guilty in July, and he was sentenced to 11 years on WMD charges for plotting to cause an explosion at a local school. There's a heroin trafficker. There's a list of very egregious offenses, and I think the regime would be happy to get a few of those people. I'm not sure if the Biden administration will go for those ones.
So two of the cases you just mentioned, one involving a man who set off an explosive device at his home, Irfan Salmanzadeh, and another man, an Iranian citizen who was convicted of drug trafficking, Malik Mohammed Baluchzehi. Those two cases don't seem to have any relation to U.S.-Iran tensions. But all of the others, the other nine, in one way or another, are connected to tensions between the U.S. and Iran, whether it's violating economic sanctions or military sanctions, or acting as an agent of Iran, or plotting to kill someone on the behest of Iran. Do you think that Iran would be more interested in having those kinds of individuals freed rather than the other two who were not arrested for doing anything, let's say, to help Iran?
That's a great point. Some of the folks that are still in prison or awaiting sentencing or trial are illicit procurement agents, and they're actually the people that go and live abroad or they're adopted by the regime to do work for them to procure the goods that Tehran uses in its military, missile, and nuclear programs. So the regime actually really prizes these people. They may seem like the little fish, but the regime thinks they are the big fish. They represent the nuts and bolts of the Iranian weapons system. So it tries to protect them. So it definitely notices when we get them, when we manage to prosecute and put them in prison. There's a few candidates, I think, that are on the list for a swap. And in previous years, the Obama administration released illicit procurement agents. There's Mehrdad Ansari. He's serving 5 years for procuring illicit goods for Iran. His case was part of a major sting operation by Homeland Security investigations, where they actually lured him to the country of Georgia and they arrested and extradited him. There's another gentleman named Reza Alangin, and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison, which is one of the longest sentences that we see for illicit procurement cases for procuring anti-aircraft missiles. And it would be a real shame if a precedent is set where all this work by U.S. law enforcement is disrupted and simply just wiped away. Painstaking investigations, sting operations, and it really sets a chilling precedent for prosecutors to go after these folks and for investigators to even do the work on the ground.
You mentioned Mehrdad Ansari. He's actually due to be released at the end of his prison term in December this year. There's another individual, Kambiz Atarkashani, whose release date is in February 2024, so that's less than a year from now. Do you think the U.S. would be willing to grant an early release to those individuals whose release is coming up soon anyway?
I think we would see that it would be more palatable publicly for them to say, well, they're coming up on the end of their sentences, so it's not that big of a deal. But it is a big deal. There's no equivalence between illicit procurement agents or people committing terrorism in the United States and are tried fairly and throughout our legal process. There's no equivalence with the people that are innocently abducted in Iran just for visiting their families or carrying out studies.
Well, I understand your point, but what would you say to those who would argue if we're going to get Americans released by Iran, Iran needs something in return? So is it better to just do one-for-one trades of people or to release, you know, $6 billion worth of funds as the U.S. is considering doing as part of this current deal? These are Iranian funds that were locked up in South Korea and are supposed to be transferred through various means to Iran for humanitarian use. What do you think is better to do here?
Well, you know, I want to be sensitive to the families that are facing this horror, because if it were our family members, we would certainly do anything we could to get them out. But I think we need to think about the precedent that we set by, in particular, freeing up assets. So the Trump administration, they swapped two people for two people held by Iran, and they were on relatively lesser offenses, and they didn't unfreeze any assets. Ideally, we don't even do that. We could attempt to use some kind of coercion where we say, look, something very negative is going to happen on your territory if you don't release our people. I think that would be better to try than encouraging further hostage taking and, in effect, paying a ransom. And what we can really try to push for in the future is that an administration needs to demand that no more of this hostage taking can occur. And that if it does, there will be extremely negative consequences for Iran.
Well, Andrea Stricker, research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, great to have you back on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
One issue that the developing U.S.-Iran deal has not addressed so far is the fate of several Iranian residents of the U.S. who have been jailed in Iran for years on what their families and rights activists say are phony charges. One of them is Jamshid Sharmad, an Iranian dissident with German citizenship who had been a U.S. resident for about 18 years when Iranian agents apparently kidnapped him as he traveled in Dubai on business in 2020. He was sentenced to death earlier this year for alleged terror offenses. His Los Angeles-based daughter, Ghazelle Sharmad, traveled to Washington last Friday with the support of several NGOs, including the National Union for Democracy in Iran, or NUFDI, to advocate for her father to be included in a U.S.-Iran prisoner deal. I caught up with Gazelle on Monday at her sit-in outside the State Department and asked what kind of help she has been getting.
Well, the first thing is what they started here was a sit-in strike, just to be present in front of the State Department and see every employee that's coming in here and see the press and every, like, be in their face and be there. A lot of them helped me to write all of the representatives, the Congress, let them know I'm here, I want to meet them, send letters to the State Department. She's here in town, she wants to meet you guys. We have a candlelight vigil coming up on Thursday. We have a roundtable in Nufti's office on Tuesday. So anybody that comes with ideas and comes prepared to help.
How much progress have you made in terms of getting those meetings that I know you want with U.S. officials here at the State Department, in this building right next to us, with members of Congress?
Members of Congress, the appointments are coming up right now. The emails were sent this morning. I came on a Friday. It was the weekend. So this morning they were sent and they're responding. So I don't know how many, but they said a bunch have already responded and we're setting it up.
Setting up meetings actually with the members of Congress?
Well, Congress is a summer break right now, so it will be their staff, which is very disappointing and very bad that all of this is happening during this summer time. But it's better than nothing, like having them and having somebody we can talk to. But the State Department has not responded yet. The White House has not responded yet.
Well, we are sitting right outside the State Department and you see staff come in and out. In these last couple of days, have you had any interactions at all, or is it really hard?
I did have interactions, but because of their off the record, I was hoping that I can have an interaction inside and talk about it, because it doesn't help me if I just run into somebody and I can't talk about what they said. I need real answers and I need real decisions.
So the State Department actually did publicly talk about your father's case just last week. I believe that was for the first time.
For the first time after 3 years.
The 3 years since he had been apparently abducted in Dubai while he was on that business trip. So the State Department effectively said it believes your father is wrongfully detained because it said he was subjected to a sham trial. But at the same time that they said that, they also said he's a German citizen and we believe that it's Germany's responsibility in terms of trying to get his release. So we have this U.S. law known as the Levinson Act. It requires the U.S. government to work for the release of all U.S. nationals. And U.S. nationals are defined as people who have permanent residency and significant ties to the U.S. So what that law doesn't address specifically is, what if that U.S. national is also the citizen of a friendly country, like Germany, for example, who the U.S. would normally expect to work for the release as well? And in this case, Germany has said it's trying to do something to help your father. But when I look at the law, I feel like, could this be a gray area where you have this U.S. national who's a citizen of a friendly country and that country is doing something? So does the U.S. have a justification in your view to say your father is someone else's responsibility?
Well, it becomes a gray area if you want it to be a gray area. But you can also take responsibility and use this law to do something for your citizens, for your residents, for people who came to this country, worked hard, and every essence are an American, and were kidnapped, were terrorized here. I mean, there is a reason that we came over here. My grandma came over here decades ago. She's the first of four generations of U.S. citizens that we have with my daughter. But the thing that they do with my dad right now, pushing off the responsibility to another country, is nothing new. One of the hostages that is included in this deal to release hostages is Murat Tapas. He has citizenship of the UK as well. And they have been playing this game with him too. He was included in a release negotiation 2 years ago, 1 year ago, where Nazanin Radcliffe was released and he was left behind. So they do that instead of seeing our nations working together to free all of the hostages, which we've asked them time and time over again. They use this opportunity to push off responsibility and play with your life. And this is disgusting to see that you're used in this way. Instead of having two countries that support you, you have neither one of them, and both fail you miserably.
So if we're in a situation where you believe the U.S. is not fulfilling its legal responsibility to secure the safe return of a U.S. national, what can you do about that? Like, are there any legal recourses that you have?
Well, we have the law on our side because, as we said, now we have the Levinson Law since 2020 when it was approved. We have our lawyers that have close ties here in D.C., but we also have the UN Working Group of Arbitrary Detention that clearly defines that my dad is arbitrarily detained. What you can do to push your government to do the right thing, I don't know. That's what I'm learning in these 3 years. What does it take? Does it take a hunger strike? Does it take something that, do I have to kill myself until they listen to me? Do I have to become like a politician pretty much and start lobbying here?
You're a nurse. This is not your profession.
That's actually my profession is like to save lives, and none of my patients have to come to me and beg to save my life. Like, I know what to do. And I know that this is my responsibility, but for some reason, our governments have forgotten that their number one reason that we have governments is to protect their citizens, to protect their residents from terrorists. And that is your number one duty. But we have to remind them, we have to force them to do it. And this is just so exhausting that we have to do it and have no life, pretty much. Like, since my father was kidnapped and taken, actually, since my father was almost assassinated here in Los Angeles, on U.S. soil, we have no life anymore. That has destroyed our family, and we don't see the support that we would need. And I don't think if anybody else was in our shoes, we have so many activists right now, like my dad, who are being terrorized, who are being persecuted, who are being subject to like almost kidnapping cases. I don't think it would be any different in their cases. So what does that mean when our governments don't step in when we need them to save us from terrorists?
Well, let's see where the U.S. government goes with this case. Ghazal Sharmad, daughter of Jamshid Sharmad, speaking to us here outside the State Department. Thank you very much for coming back on to Flashpoint Iran, and we wish you the best.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran has been promoting a Spanish translation of a memoir by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei at book fairs across Latin America this year. The Middle East Media Research Institute, a U.S. nonprofit group also known as Memory, says the book titled Cell No. 14 has appeared at fairs in Venezuela, Colombia, and Cuba. I spoke on the phone with Memory's Vice President Alberto Fernandez, a former U.S. ambassador, and asked whether Iran's book campaign is making an impact on Latin American people.
Obviously, what Iran and its allies in the region are doing is they're investing a lot in propaganda. They think it's important. They think that either there is an audience or, which is more likely, that over time they can develop an audience, that they can develop a community which is supportive, interested, that can be mobilized. And I think if you look at what's happened in Latin America after years of this work, this propaganda work by Iran and its allies, you know, whether Hispan TV and other outlets, they have developed a public, you know, they have developed a clientele. It doesn't mean that everybody accepts everything. I would say that there's a broader acceptance of Iranian political framing or political goals than, say, the religious element. But, you know, there's not a huge difference for the Iranians between kind of the religious element and the political element. They're pushing along both of those axes. Even if there's a small audience, they think that they can grow it over time, and they're making the investment to do so.
What kinds of audiences, what kinds of demographics do you think Iran is going for with its propaganda? Which kinds of demographics would be most open to its message, do you think?
Well, as I said, you know, there are political audiences and there are kind of religious audiences. Like religious audiences, there has been over the past decade, couple of decades, in fact, an effort by both Iran and by Sunni Islamists to evangelize, to propagate their ideology, their religious ideology in the West, including in Latin America. There's been a big effort made in Spanish. So there's a kind of a religious proselytizing imperative that happens. The other one, which is, you know, I kind of call it like a reverse Che Guevara. You know, Che Guevara was this Latin American, of course, Argentine revolutionary who didn't do that much, but he became this icon of revolution, including an icon of revolution in the Middle East, in the Arab world, in Iran, and elsewhere in the East. So what they're trying to do, what Iran is interested in doing, is kind of, as I said, a reverse Che Guevara, promoting the idea of revolution along the lines of the Islamic Republic in the West, in America's backyard, in the Spanish language, among communities and ethnicities where American intelligence and American authorities are not necessarily going to have their radar up about people coming in or concerns about suspicious characters.
You mentioned the proselytizing that Iran likes to do in the region. Why do you think the leaders of countries like Venezuela and Colombia, which are Christian, predominantly Catholic nations, would accept proselytizing from a government that has this radical Islamist ideology? Wouldn't that go against their own religious beliefs and values?
Well, not at all, because, of course, the people in charge in these countries are not practicing Christians generally. They're leftists. And, you know, if you look at Venezuela, you look at Colombia, you look at Argentina, these are all countries where the left is in power. And the left is in an informal, in Latin America, is an informal ally of Iran. They're both anti-Western. They're both anti-American. So they see Iran as a political ally. Why not allow them to proselytize, right? So what? These are not people who are themselves very religious. It's not like they're out defending Christianity or the church. What they're interested in themselves, whether Maduro or Daniel Ortega or whoever, they're interested in revolution. They have a kind of an ideological framework, which is communist, left-wing, far-left base. And there's an overlap that exists between Iran's goals and the goals of the left. If you look at Hispan TV, for example, which is funded by Iran, a lot of their content is left-wing. Even though leftists are persecuted in Iran, in Latin America, Iran promotes leftist ideology or left-wing critiques of the West and of the United States, while also promoting their own Iranian revolutionary goals.
When it comes to U.S. national security interests, you know, we talked about Iran bringing its ideology into America's backyard. How concerned should the U.S. be about this trend, and what should the U.S. do about it?
Well, we should be very concerned when you look at the propaganda and the ideology, when you look at the books and the music videos that they're putting out. They want people to be martyrs. They want people to be like Qasem Soleimani. They want people to be like the foot soldiers of Hezbollah fighting Israel. Well, this is a national security threat for the United States.
Is there anything that the U.S. can actually do about Iran's cultural ties with any country in that region?
Well, obviously, one thing that the U.S. must do is make it an issue of bilateral discussion with these Latin American governments. Now, the challenge there is that some of these governments, of course, are extremely hostile to the United States. You know, if you talk about Venezuela, it's not going to do anything. But other countries which may be permissive in allowing this to happen, even though there may be a left wing, say Colombia or Argentina, those are countries where the U.S. does have a bilateral relationship, and certainly talking to them, warning them about it, is a first step that has to be done. That people are being indoctrinated, they're being indoctrinated in ways which are going to lead to them carrying out violent acts at some point.
Well, Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, Vice President of the Middle East Media Research Institute, speaking to us from Virginia. Glad you could join us this week on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
That's a wrap of the program. If you've got ideas for other topics that you'd like to hear on the show, let me know on the X social media platform, where you can find me at Michael_Lipin. We have more episodes on Apple and Google Podcasts, and we'll have a new Flashpoint Iran for you next week.